Willkommen bei Zaren, Daten, Fakten.
Вы говорите по-русски? Kann noch jemand Russisch?
Говорит Москва.
Russland ist ein Rätsel. Innerhalb eines Geheimnisses, umgeben von einem Mysterium.
A warm welcome to a new episode of the Zaren, Daten, Fakten podcast. My name is Thomas Bayer for the German-Russian Chamber of Commerce. And today we want to talk about a very interesting topic, a very interesting region. Today we want to talk about the Arctic. And we are joined today by Pavel Devyatkin. He's a senior associate and leadership group member at the Arctic Institute. The Arctic Institute is a non-profit organization headquartered in Washington, D.C., and is considered the preeminent independent think tank of all matters Arctic. Pavel Devyatkin is also a visiting lecturer at the Higher School of Economics in Moscow. So Pavel, thank you very much for taking the time for coming on the Zaren, Daten, Fakten podcast. I know that you also speak German. You lived in Germany as well. So let me know, should we do today the episode in German or English? What is more comfortable for you?
Oh, hello, Thomas. Thank you very much for having me. Ja, ich spreche zwar Deutsch, aber meine Forschung erfolgt hauptsächlich auf Englisch und Russisch. Ja, ich möchte sagen Hallo an alle meine Freunde in Deutschland, aber los geht's auf Englisch. It's better in English because most of my research is in that language. But thank you.
Yeah, let's talk about the Russian Arctic strategy a little bit. The last version of the Russian Arctic strategy was released 4 years ago in 2020, and it has a time frame until 2035. So what do we have to know as people who don't study really the Arctic? What do we have to know about the Russian strategy?
Yeah, that's a great question, because Russia's Arctic policy has been published in several strategic documents. You can follow it in the rhetoric of politicians, especially the president, Vladimir Putin, and the foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov. I would say Russia's Arctic policy can be summarized in five parts. First, to use the Arctic as a strategic energy and natural resource base. Second, to manage the Northern Sea Route and the maritime shipping lanes in the Russian Arctic to mainly transport extracted resources. Third, to support scientific research and collaborative projects. And then fourth, to improve the lives of Arctic residents, including the indigenous people that have lived there for millennia. And then lastly, but not least, and perhaps the most controversial of Russia's Arctic policy, is to secure Russia's economic interests and sovereignty in the region with a comprehensive land, sea, and air military presence. So, of course, Russia has important socioeconomic interests in the Arctic, and they're related mostly to the dramatic changes in the climate and environment that are going on in the region. We could talk about how approximately two-thirds of all Russian oil and gas is estimated to be found in Russia's Arctic territories and exclusive economic zone, and up to 20% of Russia's GDP and 10% of Russia's exports are generated in its Arctic territories. So, because its economy is dependent on the extraction, production, and export of oil and gas, especially, Russia definitely sees the region as vital for its economic development and its future.
Of course, Russia is not the only state with territorial claims in the Arctic. What are other states in the Arctic? And also, there's this Arctic Council. A lot of the listeners have probably heard this term Arctic Council. What is the Arctic Council, and what countries are currently in the Arctic Council, and why is this an important body of managing the affairs in the Arctic?
Yeah, so the Arctic Council is an intergovernmental forum, not an international organization, but a forum, so a platform for discussion of political, social, economic, scientific issues in the Arctic. It was founded in 1996 by the eight Arctic nations in alphabetic order: Canada, Denmark, Finland, Iceland, Norway, Russia, Sweden, and the USA. It was founded in 1996 with the Ottawa Declaration, and it has a specific mandate to especially look at issues of sustainable development and environmental protection. And it's been the platform for successful negotiation of legally binding agreements on search and rescue operations in 2011, on marine oil pollution preparedness and response in 2013, and enhancing Arctic scientific cooperation in 2017. So it can be seen as an exemplar of post-Cold War constructive diplomacy and cooperation. And since its founding in 1996, it has risen to the top of the foreign policy agendas of the eight Arctic states. And it's also unique in that it has permanent participants, including NGOs, but most interestingly, has six organizations that represent the indigenous peoples of the Arctic and far north. So this is perhaps the only situation in international affairs where indigenous peoples, for example, the people of the Inuit, the Sami, the Gwich'in, and the Aleut, play a role in the negotiation in these important cooperative agreements. Since the start of the conflict in Ukraine in 2014, and also since February 2022, there have been some complications, especially after 2014. There were sanctions and counter-sanctions that, and also some temporary pauses in the cooperation in the Arctic Council, boycotts of some working groups. After 2022, we saw for the first time a comprehensive pause by the seven Arctic states, excluding Russia. They paused the Arctic Council. They condemned Russia's actions in Ukraine. And this was during Russia's leadership, Russia's chairmanship of the Arctic Council. So it caused a big problem for Arctic cooperation. Many scientists, especially many indigenous peoples, diplomats were writing many articles and op-eds about the problem that there was a severing of ties in important research related to climate change, important dialogue and cooperation related to environmental protection. Cooperation between the coast guards, for example, was affected, and communication channels, diplomatic channels were severed. Now in 2024, we're seeing a gradual resumption of cooperation in the Arctic Council. We're seeing virtual meetings resume now that Norway has taken over the chairmanship of the Arctic Council after Russia had its 2 years from 2021 to 2023. Since 2023, and now we are in May, approaching the 1 year anniversary of Norway's chairmanship, Norway has played a constructive role in opening up dialogue with Russia and has had virtual meetings with the Russian Minister of Foreign Affairs and permanent participants such as the representatives of the indigenous peoples of the Russian far north. So whereas there's a lot of media and hype about the end of Arctic cooperation, we can still see that there is some headways in terms of individual to individual level cooperation, informal cooperation, some organizational cooperation, but still the story is not completely positive, as we've heard recent rhetoric from Russia about suspending funding of the Arctic Council and also the potential to leave the Arctic Council, the forum that it has co-founded together with the other Western Arctic states in 1996.
You mentioned already that cooperation has resumed, but it's mostly online. So I was asking myself right now, is there a headquarter of the Arctic Council? For example, the United Nations, they're located in New York. So where is the headquarter of the Arctic Council, or is it always like online meetings and everybody is sitting in their own country, or are they meeting somewhere? And also you mentioned the funding. How much funding does the Arctic Council have? Is it an organization with a lot of resources, with a high budget? How do we have to imagine this Arctic Council?
Yeah, so the Arctic Council, it's a forum. It's more of a setting for dialogue between the eight Arctic states and the NGOs and permanent participants. And most of the funding comes from the chair of the Arctic Council. The current chair is Norway and will be until 2025. As I understand, the Arctic Council secretariat is currently in Tromsø, in the far north of Norway.
So generally, maybe some information about the Arctic. Probably most of the listeners, they are not experts in the Arctic. Maybe you can give us some general information, like how many people live there. What else do we have to know about the Arctic? How many resources are located in the Arctic? What do we have to know as general listeners about the Arctic?
The Arctic is generally defined as the region of the world above the 66-degree latitude line. So it's basically the Arctic Circle in the north, where the polar bears live. The penguins don't live there. The penguins live in Antarctica in the South Pole. About 4 million people live in the Arctic, and about 2.5 million of those live in the Russian Arctic. Russia is the biggest Arctic state. In terms of resources, the Arctic has been seen as a region that is important for economic development and energy extraction, especially in terms of oil and gas. There's also many natural resources or rare earth metals as well that are important for the economies of the Arctic states. The warming of the region has led to a lot of, and by the way, the warming of the region, it's warming 3 to 4 times faster than the rest of the world. The warming of the region has led to predictions of increased accessibility of natural resources and also accessibility to new maritime shipping lanes, such as the Northern Sea Route. On one hand, the warming of the region and the decrease of the sea ice provides for more favorable conditions for such economic activities. Operating costs could be lower. Equipment could be more effective during warmer conditions, so it could be easier to access natural resources. But on the other hand, it's important to have a reality check that climate change also creates unfavorable conditions for economic activities, because global warming leads to changes in weather, in precipitation, wind and wave activities, storms, the erosion of coasts. And these processes could all negatively impact the infrastructure and machinery, and therefore raise the costs of operation. The Russian Arctic is particularly under threat by climate change and those effects of climate change. The economic cost of climate change to Arctic infrastructure may amount to up to 9 trillion rubles, or about 90 billion euros, by the year 2050. And that's according to research by the Ministry for the Development of the Far East and the Arctic in Russia. Every year, the Russian Arctic loses about 7,000 hectares of land to the erosion of coasts. And this is an area about the size of central Moscow. And that's not to mention, of course, how people are affected, how people must migrate, and indigenous and traditional ways of life are affected by climate change. Dozens of apartment buildings have collapsed, and hundreds of buildings have been damaged by the thawing permafrost. While most of your listeners would, if they were to read about the changes going on in the Arctic, they would hear about the accessibility of natural resources and the coming boom for the Arctic economy. But I would just encourage your listeners to remember that there's also a negative aspect to the climate change that is affecting the Arctic. That is something also that we have to consider.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about the warming of the Arctic. Also in Moscow, for example, in the beginning of April, the highest temperature was measured since recording. And you mentioned that the Arctic is even 4 times faster warming than other parts of the world. So there are many negative effects. You mentioned them already. But some people believe that especially the shipping lane the so-called Northern Sea route could benefit Russia's trade and the shipping industry generally. So in the Arctic strategy in 2020, I believe there was an emphasis put on this Northern Sea route, and there were specific goals also written down. So how would you evaluate right now the Northern Sea route? Is it because of climate change that more and more ships can pass this Northern Sea route, can save time, don't have to go other routes that would take longer time? And is Russia achieving the goals that were set in 2020 regarding this NSR, the Northern Sea Route?
Yeah, so the development of the Northern Sea Route, which runs from the Novaya Zemlya, dual islands in the west of the Russian Arctic, to the Bering Strait, has been a priority for Russia for many decades, even during the Soviet period. And the impacts of climate change, the melting sea ice and the warming air and sea temperatures, are increasing the potential for maritime shipping, but also creating environmental risks and hazards. Generally, the Northern Sea Route could facilitate shorter transit times and lower fuel costs, and even lower the levels of the emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases compared to other shipping routes. It could be, for example, 40% shorter than the traditional shipping route that goes through the Suez Canal. After the blocking of the Suez Canal in 2021 and the ongoing war in Palestine, the Houthi rebels' attacks on ships in the Red Sea, there have been discussions about how there are political benefits or security-related benefits for countries to operate in the Northern Sea Route. But generally, there's still a lot of skeptics about the feasibility, the current feasibility of the Northern Sea Route, because it's, to this day, still only been mostly used for the shipping of hydrocarbons from Russia to China. So the shipping of resources, whereas many have predicted container shipping, that is the shipping of goods, consumer goods, from the far eastern markets in China through the Russian Arctic to the Western European markets, such as in Rotterdam. That has not completely materialized. The bulk of the shipping along the Northern Sea Route is domestic or cabotage shipping, and it's more suitable for tankers and bulk cargo, especially liquefied natural gas. So the Northern Sea Route is not suitable for liner shipping in the short term. It could be by 2050. It could be when the sea ice is not there anymore. But the Northern Sea Route still remains a perilous place of hazards and underdeveloped infrastructure. And there's still regulatory barriers to it becoming an international shipping lane. Russia, for example, has especially increased its control over the Russian Arctic shipping lanes and required foreign ships to register with the authorities. Search and rescue patrols, emergency response units are being improved, but still are underdeveloped. Insurance companies still evaluate the Russian Arctic as posing high risk. Only Russia possesses such a dramatic fleet, such a huge fleet of icebreaker vessels to escort these commercial vessels. So there's been a lot of hype about what has been called the Polar Silk Road, or China's plan for developing or supporting the development of the Arctic together with Russia as part of its large geoeconomic strategy called the Belt and Road Initiative. But so far, there's still a lot of skepticism from both the Russian and Chinese sides. So as you mentioned, in 2018, President Putin announced the goal of increasing freight shipping along the Northern Sea Route to 80 million tons by 2024. And by the end of this year, 2024, and most analysts would say that they're on the way to achieve that goal, but it's still mostly hydrocarbons, and there's still lots of concerns related to the port facilities, the conditions of the climate, the natural environment. So in the short term, it still won't increase to the level of the Suez Canal shipping route, for example.
You mentioned China already, and also you mentioned the shipping of hydrocarbons from Russia to China via NSR Northern Sea Route. What other international partnerships is Russia looking for to enhance its Arctic economic activities? Is it mostly China? Are the Russians basically looking to China for capital, for technology, to make this development happening in the Arctic? Or are there any other states that show interest in cooperating with Russia in the Arctic?
Yeah, at the economic level, China has played a key role in the Arctic in cooperating with Russia, especially since February 2022. There's been a lot of rhetoric from both the Russian and Chinese sides expressing interests in further developing Arctic cooperation. China has played a significant role in the liquefied natural gas projects, Yamal LNG and Arctic LNG 2. The Chinese National Petroleum Corporation and the Silk Road Fund that are part of the Chinese government own 20 and 9.9% respectively of the Yamal LNG project, and then also have stakes in the Arctic LNG project. There have been French and American and Western European, other Western companies operating and cooperating with Russia. But since 2014 and since 2022, there have been suspensions of such cooperation at the economic level. The Russia-China partnership is still a hotly debated topic, and the Arctic aspects of the relationship are still ambiguous. China has expressed, or especially the officials of the Chinese government, have expressed solidarity with Russia after the pause of the Arctic Council. And there have been significant headways in scientific cooperation, where Russia has welcomed Chinese researchers and institutions into Arctic research projects, especially after the visit of a U.S. House Speaker, or a former Speaker of the House in the U.S., Nancy Pelosi. When she visited Taiwan in 2022, China has canceled its relations with the U.S. on climate change and regional security, maritime safety. And now China is especially working more closely with Russia. There's also a lot of hype around a potential Chinese military presence in the Arctic. In general, a fully fledged Chinese military presence in the Arctic is improbable, because the first to object to such a Chinese military presence would be the Russians, because Russia has its own comprehensive military complex in the Arctic. But there are indications that Russia has been working together with the Chinese military in the region. For example, in 2022, the U.S. Coast Guard encountered Chinese and Russian vessels operating together in the Bering Sea. And after Xi Jinping visited Moscow last year, we could expect that China will participate in more military exercises with Russia. China has tried to portray itself as neutral in the Russia-Ukraine war. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs of China have stated that they don't want to be affected by the Western sanctions related to Ukraine and to potentially undermine business ties. During the first half of 2022, Chinese investments as part of the Belt and Road Initiative almost went to zero. Chinese purchases of Russian oil and gas increased. But despite this hype around the Polar Silk Road in the Russian Arctic, the maritime shipping route in the Russian Arctic, the Chinese overseas shipping company suspended its shipping in 2022. This is important because this company, the Chinese Overseas Shipping Company, or COSCO for short, has been the main international operator on the Northern Sea Route since around 2013 and has had over 100 voyages on the route. But after Xi Jinping's Moscow visit, we can expect there will be a joint development of the Northern Sea Route. There's also some legal disagreements over Russia's historical claim to the Northern Sea Route, that Russia claims it as historical Russian internal waters, whereas Chinese commentators, analysts, and scholars are more aligned with the Western view that the Northern Sea Route should be viewed as international waters. This is something similar to the position taken by the United States. There are several developments whereas Western companies have left the Russian Arctic, have stopped investing and cooperating at the economic level with Russia. China has filled that gap. But the relationship between Russia and China is still ambiguous because we see that China still strives to be neutral in the Russia-Ukraine war. And there are some disagreements. And anecdotally, there's many, many examples of skepticism in the expert communities of Russia and China.
You mentioned already that there is some conflict or some disagreement regarding territorial claims in the Arctic, especially in view of the NSR, the Northern Sea Route. Are there any other territorial claims that are overlapping in the Arctic between the members of the Arctic Council? And also in the beginning, you mentioned that Russia is thinking about leaving this council. What would be the motivation for Russia to leave this council?
Russian officials have talked about potentially leaving the Arctic Council if it continues down the path of being an anti-Russian forum. So now that 7 of the 8 Arctic states are members of NATO, since Finland and Sweden have recently joined, there is an increasing perception from the Russian foreign policy establishment that the Arctic Council could be becoming an anti-Russian forum. I think it's very improbable that Russia would leave the Arctic Council, especially since it co-founded the Arctic Council in 1996. But there was a similar organization called the Barents Euro-Arctic Council, which is a similar grouping of states to the Arctic Council, minus the North American Arctic states. It's for the Barents region in the European Arctic. And Russia withdrew from that Barents Euro-Arctic Council at the end of last year because of this rationale that the council was becoming anti-Russian. The rationale for that was also because the chairmanship of the Barents Euro-Arctic Council was meant to be transferred to Russia, but because of the complications related to Ukraine, the Russians realized that it would not have been productive. When it comes to territorial disputes, there are no acute territorial disputes in the Arctic because any disputes can be negotiated under the auspices of international law. We saw Russia in previous years submit an application to the United Nations Commission on the Continental Shelf with data from researchers showing that certain parts of the undersea Arctic continental shelf are proven to be part of the Russian continent. And after analysis by the United Nations body, the application was approved and the continental shelf, the Russian claim was approved. So that was an example where Russia affected its claim to the Arctic undersea territory under the auspices of international law. We also saw in 2010, during the Dmitry Medvedev presidency, Russia and Norway concluded a landmark treaty on the delimitation of the Barents Sea. So after over 40 years of negotiation and disagreements, Norway and Russia agreed on the border, the maritime border between Norway and Russia. And it's interesting, at the time, the prime minister of Norway was the current head of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg. That agreement can be seen in the context of the politicians' interest in improving their political relations, in maintaining economic cooperation. And it shows that disagreements on the border can be negotiated maybe it will take 40 years, but in the end will can still be successfully agreed upon in the end. We saw another development recently at the end of last year where the U.S. unilaterally claimed an extension of its continental shelf, some of which extending into the Arctic. Importantly, this claim does not overlap with any other country's claims, but the after a few months, the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs have said that they do not recognize the United States' claim. And it's controversial because the United States is not a party, has not ratified the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. Russia is a part of the Law of the Sea, and that has been the framework under which Russia submitted its claim to the continental shelf. But even among the American foreign policy establishment, the Arctic expert community in the United States, there have been discussions about the mistake of the unilateral claim to these territories because where the U.S. upholds a rules-based order, what is the role of the rules-based order when the claim is unilateral and only afterwards contingent on the negotiation with the affected countries, because Canada and Japan in the North Pacific also potentially have claims to these territories that have been claimed by the U.S. But in general, there are no acute territorial disputes in the Arctic that cannot be negotiated under the auspices of international law, even if they can be controversial and tricky at times, like the case of the recent U.S. unilateral claim. But the record shows that there has been constructive dialogue and negotiation of such disputes.
Now we come already to the last question, and we want to look a little bit into the distant future, because the last Russian Arctic strategy was written in 2020 and it was until 2035. So let's swing a little bit in time and look ahead, because after 2035, there will probably be a new Russian Arctic strategy, probably until 2050. What can we expect in the distant, maybe not so distant future after 2035?
Yeah, so the main thing is that in 2035, climate change will continue to affect the Arctic, and we will see more warming and decreased sea ice, more thawing permafrost. And in terms of the security situation, one thing that is particularly worrisome is that the arms control regime in the Arctic, especially, but in the whole world, is at risk. That in 2026, the last remaining arms control treaty, the New START treaty, will expire. And after that, there will be no strategic arms control in place. And this is especially important for the Arctic because the Arctic has been the region of confrontation during the Cold War, as the region of the shortest distance of missile attack, has been the region for deterrence from especially the U.S. and USSR. And today, nuclear weapons are significant to Russia's security strategy. For example, the Tsirkon hypersonic cruise missiles are used in Arctic military exercises, and the Sarmat land-based intercontinental ballistic missiles have been put on combat duty at the end of last year. This is sooner than 2035, but it's scary to think that the security situation might be aggravated. We're still not sure how the war in Ukraine will end, whether a diplomatic a resolution will prevail, whether cooperation, especially at the scientific level, related to jointly understanding the dramatic changes unfolding in the region, whether that cooperation will return. There's certainly a lot of interest in the expert communities, scientific epistemic communities of the Arctic states, But at the official government-to-government level, there is still a lot of problems and obstacles in the implementation of this. So in general, climate change will continue to be a key factor in determining the situation in the Arctic. And whereas natural resources may be more accessible and the diminishing sea ice might make the shipping lanes of the Arctic more accessible, there's still environmental hazards and risks. And there's need for the development of infrastructure, especially ports. But as we can see in Russia, there's been a very significant policies from the federal government to encourage people to migrate to the Arctic to improve the living standards of the Arctic regions. So by 2035, we may even see a very significant development in living standards and the socioeconomic situation in the Arctic at the domestic level as well.
Pavel, thank you very much for taking the time, for giving us an overview over the Arctic, also over the Russian Arctic strategy, which is not so new anymore. It's already 4 years ago that the strategy was written, and also for giving us an overview over the Arctic Council, which was founded in 1996. So how can people follow your work? And maybe this was a little teaser about the Arctic. If they want to deepen their knowledge of the Arctic, how can they follow you, and what kind of resources would you recommend people if they want to really dive deeper into the Arctic?
Yeah, thank you very much, Tomas. It's been a pleasure to speak with you and to explore these questions. For your listeners, thank you very much for joining us for this episode. And if you're interested in Arctic affairs from an economic, social, political, historical, scientific, military security perspective, really encourage you to check out the Arctic Institute website. We have many articles, reports, interviews, videos, conferences, events that focus on these questions on the 8 Arctic states, but also the interests of non-Arctic states like China, India, Japan. Thank you very much, Thomas.
Dieser Podcast wurde präsentiert von der Deutsch-Russischen Auslandshandelskammer. Die Deutsch-Russische Auslandshandelskammer ist mit 1000 Mitgliedern der größte ausländische Wirtschaftsverband in Russland.